You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 19th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rolling Stone contributor, author, Matt Taibbi. On our insane clown president and his dispatches from the 2016 circus. Also on the program today, the Trump Organization plans cuts to everything that makes our government civilized. Powered by the Heritage Foundation. Also on the program today, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price threatens to sue CNN for reporting on his stock trades.
Bold move.
Meanwhile, Earth, congratulations on setting a new high record temperature again. That's great.
We're all going to die.
Yes.
Except really, honestly.
Meanwhile, six agencies are reportedly continuing to investigate our next president for getting financing from Russia for his campaign.
But this is ridiculous.
Speaking of ridiculous, Rick Perry took a job of energy secretary and apparently had no idea. No. Not no idea. Had the wrong idea as to what the energy department did. It's true. And I voted for Trump not to cut Planned Parenthood, writes an op-ed columnist in USA Today. And Paul Ryan has come to Jesus in the form of Steve Bannon. Oh, yes, folks. All this and more on today's Majority Report. We may have to rename this program, like Majority Report, the final voyage.
The final.
So, folks, still, I got to be honest with you. I don't know what we're going to do to cover the inauguration tomorrow. I think what we're going to do is probably watch it and do a little bit of Mystery Science 3000 to it. And I don't know. I mean, to some extent, I've been in denial. Now it's suddenly it's Thursday. I was hoping that maybe, I don't know, we'd get struck by a meteor.
Can we just do like a radio play and ignore it? Like, we could just do like the secret meetings between Russia, Trump, and right wing Mandela or something.
We may do
and just
something
completely
like
ignore
that.
It.
I don't know.
I kind of don't even want to give it a ratings point.
It won't. I promise you that anything that we do, we will steal the footage. I mean, we'll go out of our way to make sure this doesn't register anywhere. You know, it is reality, and to a certain extent, we got to suck it up. I mean, with that said, there's going to be some disrespect, and so if you're a little sensitive to the idea that we might disrespect, old triple chins or.
Those are the best comments ever, particularly when people would stumble upon us for a Republican debate or something, and they'd all be like, "You guys got no respect. I thought I was watching a goddamn illegal stream of the debate. Instead, I see a couple of Jews mocking American heroes."
And the weird part is that They would write in that sort of drawl.
You can infer it.
Right. Speaking of respect, my understanding is that the president electoral, Donald Trump, has been busy writing his own inaugural speech. And how do I know this? Because the president electoral actually tweeted out a picture of himself writing the speech. Now, here he is. You can see he's sitting at what looks like a very important desk. It is a leather top desk with
looks like it was stolen from Saddam Hussein.
There's a huge eagle on the desk, a statue, of course, not a real one. Behind him, a very ornate, I mean, this is extremely unique. I can't imagine you would find this anywhere else. This, of course, is from Mar-a-Lago, whatever he calls it, the Winter White House. And it is, there's an ornate tiling in the back. And there he is. He's sort of pensively looking up a little bit at the camera, but of course, bending his writing pad, as you all do. When you write, of course, you bend your pad towards you so that there's some, I don't know, well, maybe that's a technique.
And look up at the cameraman.
And you look up at the cameraman. And of course, here he is concentrating, probably just, I don't know, maybe they have a camera fixed in his office where he does his writing. But what I find really special about this, and I contemplated this for quite a while, him sort of pensively looking about what he's going to write next in his inaugural speech. Notice there's almost nothing else around there, right? I mean, he's got a completely clean desk. It's this level of focus, folks, that you need when you construct a... what's that? Oh, no. Someone found a picture of what is that? A jewelry exhibit from the Palm Beach show group? Palm Beach Jewelry Antiques Design? And here is a woman who has given, wait, but just pull back a little bit. It's a big thank you. It's a tweet that she sent out. A big thank you to the Mar-a-Lago Club for supporting the Palm Beach Jewelry Antiques Design Show. And wait, she's sitting at a large desk that has got a leather top and gold embroidery around it. Could you zoom in just a little bit, Matt? Oh, my gosh. There's that one-of-a-kind unique backdrop that we saw. Why, yes, there she is. She is that the concierge at the Mar-a-Lago? Why would she be sitting at Donald Trump's desk? He's got all sorts of writing to do. Or maybe Donald Trump just said, let's pretend I'm going to be writing.
I'm going to need the concierge for a couple of hours.
Clear the desk off.
Clear the desk off.
Oh, there
off.
It is. There you get all the Palm Beach. They've cleared that off. And that was, maybe in a year he just took over the lobby. That's what
Give
it was.
Give me a Sharpie.
Working in the lobby to do my thing. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Well, bravo, Donald Trump.
And then the list is like, Mr. Khan, get him. Meryl right. Streep, get her.
All right. Well, just clear out the lobby and the concierge desk, and I'll sit in there, and I'll do it. I don't care. Wow. That is, I'm sure he was busy writing at his real desk. And they said, Mr. Donald Trump, can we please take your photograph so that you'd have a record of you writing this inaugural speech? And he said, actually, I don't want you to take a picture of my desk. Let's go find a different desk, and I'll just bring my notepad in which I'm working on things. Now, also, to be fair, can we push that picture back up onto the screen? Because you'll also notice that, and I want to be fair here to President Electoral Trump's. To be fair, you'll notice he's still on the first page of his notebook. And so it could be very possible that he was just struck with an idea for the inaugural speech as he was walking through the lobby.
Don't
and
know
said,
where
Wait
the,
a second.
You just don't know where the muse will take you.
You just don't know.
And you have to follow the day man.
Everybody, clear this desk off. Get out of the way. I need to write something. And people were just so stunned, like, oh my God, I better take a picture of this.
Hold on.
This looks like
hold
something
on.
Could be happening.
It's coming to me. Meryl Streep is a loser. Mr. Khan is totally pathetic. My enemies will bow down. Vladimir Putin, great guy. Hold on. Hold on. Things are going to be fantastic. They will be beautifully covered. Hillary, big time loser campaign. Bill Clinton, disgrace.
And hold someone's on. Always folk, following behind him with the eagle statue that Johnny No Socks gave him.
Yeah. Right.
Get that.
That's what that is.
Get No Socks statue.
And it could also be, you know, and I also imagine this. He's like in the middle of writing, and then all of a sudden he hears click, click, because they're taking pictures. And he just looks up. He looks right up.
I was so lost in the moment.
That eagle might, it looks like its eye. He's like, is that my nest?
It's a great fucking eagle. It's America.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, if you run or manage a small business, then you know that keeping up with human resources paperwork can be extremely overwhelming. Running a small business, it's impossible. There's so many different things you got to do. The daily grind of resolving payroll issues, chasing down data, filing, organizing, dealing with messy spreadsheets can really get in the way of you being able to focus on employees. But luckily, I've got a solution for you, Bamboo HR, the complete online HR management software for small to medium-sized businesses. Everything about Bamboo HR is designed to make life easier for business owners, human resource managers, and even employees. It's easy to use. Central system for keeping organized and detailed records of every employee. I'm looking at all of you in here. We're all from salary information to benefits to training history and more. If you don't have to worry about
not
remembering
much to keep track of.
To log on an employee's time off, because Bamboo HR does it for you. Yeah, there you go.
Excuse me.
Michael's like, I don't know if we should really institute that here. And now, for a limited time, visit bamboohr.com, click on the mic, and enter code REPORT to get a free 14-day trial. Try it. You'll wonder how you ever got along without it. HR paperwork solutions made easy. Kelly was just like looking at that going like, this is actually a really great deal. That's bamboohr.com. Enter code REPORT for a free 14-day trial.
She was looking at it more like, oh, this will threaten my various schemes.
What, Kelly? What?
That's my voice.
That's the scheme voice.
That's what happens when you should know, folks, when the microphones are turned off in this studio,
yes.
Everyone's voice sounds like an old scheming Jew.
Yes.
If I wrote down a list of my various schemes and gave it to Sam, he would lose it before he could read it.
That's probably
and
true.
And then never find
it. I can't find. I don't even know where I'm being
schemed. Where are Kelly's
schemes? I don't have time for this. I'm trying to get into a fight with my family members.
Where are Kelly's schemes?
Some guy with 3 followers on Twitter told me I didn't understand the CBO, and I'm about to ignore my daughter's phone calls so I could spend the next 5 hours arguing with him.
Inaccurate. That's the only thing he would never do. He would not ignore her phone calls.
Myla, I'm in the middle of something.
Myla, oh, there's really? Something very important happening on Twitter. Something very important happening on Twitter right now.
There's a fire at my kid's school. Was anyone hurt? No, they're just scared. Okay, fine. I got to get back to Twitter.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Matt Taibbi.
What God is
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Rolling Stone contributing writer, best-selling author, Matt Taibbi, in part, well, I guess, I don't know, exclusively, on our insane clown president and his dispatches from the 2016 circus. Matt, welcome to the program.
What's going on, Sam?
Dude, what did you do? Last time we spoke was like a half an hour before all hell broke loose on election night.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. We spoke on the phone.
Yeah.
You were like the last human being I spoke to before it all went down, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were sounding a little bit morose.
Right.
And we were like, what's up, Matt?
Don't worry, Matt.
Yeah, don't worry, Matt. It'll all be fine tomorrow.
No, actually, you know what? I think what happened was we were on the phone, and we were having this kind of morose, like, boy, doesn't this just entire election season suck kind of a conversation. And then at the end, the Florida stuff started
happening. Right. And we were both like, wow, this seems a little weird.
Right, yeah, exactly. And then the acid trip actually. You know how when you take hallucinogens, there's that one moment where you see after 40 minutes something isn't quite right, and then 5
yeah,
minutes
you're
after
just
that
like,
is when you.
Yeah. When's this stuff gonna kick in? Wait a second! Oh no!
Right. And then all of a sudden, 10 minutes later, you're crawling on the floor. That was kind of like that.
I hope this stuff kicks in soon because my arm is melting and I want to try. Wait a second. Okay, well, good talking to you, man. I mean, so tomorrow is the inauguration. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, but then, you know, we'll broaden it out.
Sure.
You know, I read a piece that you posted at Rolling Stone where you were talking about Thompson's book on Hunter Thompson's book on the 1972 campaign, which was, I guess maybe the seminal sort of campaign journal, I guess, if you will. And you wrote that it was animated by Thompson's deep, deep obsessive hate for Nixon. Was that a benchmark for you? I mean, did you set out, or was it more just fascination with Trump?
Well, just to back up, I mean, because I have the job that I have, I mean, it's like trying to play shooting guard after Michael Jordan retires or something like that, you know? I mean, it's hard not to be conscious of the whole Hunter Thompson tradition, you know, when you're covering the campaign for Rolling Stone, because it's the gold standard of this kind of writing. And, you know, the 72 campaign was I think his really his best moment, and to this day I wrote the introduction for the last edition of that, and that's like the highlight of my career so far. That book just fascinates me on a lot of levels. I think of it as being more like a novel, a little bit like The Castle or The Trial, because it's this gigantic kind of horrible journey where he's constantly searching for truth and justice and for the good guy to win out, but it's always elusive and it never quite happens and it's always just around the corner, and it ends in this spectacular defeat. And what, as you said, what animates it throughout is his like increasing loathing and hatred, but also like fascination and attraction for Nixon. I mean, it's a mix of emotions that he has for him. He doesn't just dismiss him. He's both attracted and repelled at the same time, and it just builds and builds and builds for hundreds of pages. And that's what I think made it art, you know? I mean, it separates it from just, you know, what we usually do in this business, just magazine writing. So, you know, I hate making the comparison because it's never a winning thing to do for any political writer. But I think Trump is a similar kind of figure to Nixon. He's just representative of so many different things that are horrible about our society. It just makes him an epic character on that same scale. So I guess just as a long-winded answer, you know, as a writing endeavor, he's kind of a perfect subject, I think.
I mean, so much of everything. I mean, it's interesting. There are two things that occur to me. One is that there's a big difference insofar as, and this is also something, you know, harkening back. I mean, because you and I used to talk quite a bit during the Bush years too, and that there's this difference insofar as that people are not as isolated in looking at Donald Trump as a freak and a fundamental threat, and also just sort of the repository of all the worst things about our society, right? I mean, in a way that, like, certainly in 2004, 2003, 2002, to say something like that about Bush, you'd just be ostracized on some level. I mean, you know, unless you're in the specific circles. And
right.
I think even with Nixon, to a certain extent, that was, I mean, there was definitely more of a counterculture pushback to Nixon. But broadly speaking, there wasn't the sort of, the context is different, right? I mean, like our whole society seems to understand that we have this freak and that somehow he's ascended to the presidency.
Right. Yeah. It's a completely different level of insanity. I mean, Nixon was somebody who superficially tried to be respectable and honorable, and even Thompson wrote in his famous obituary about Nixon that, you know, on paper he seemed like somebody you might even support, but what the problem was that his superficially okay exterior concealed this, like, sort of raging horribleness and corruption underneath, and that's what, you know, 60s counterculture was trying to revolt against. That's why people were dressing differently and acting outlandishly, because they were trying to rebel against this idea that America's exterior is phony and it's corrupt underneath, so we're going to be different on the outside now. But Trump is, there's no hidden anything to Trump. Trump is what he is. You know, he's not concealing another layer of something. He's openly what he is, and he's kind of openly a villain and a freak and crazy. And don't you think? I mean, it's a different thing than Nixon in that sense.
Well, that's why I think it's sort of harder to be obsessive about Trump in some way, because there's no, like, you know, I feel like Thompson was trying to reveal something about Nixon, and, you know, you can examine Trump, but, you know, like you say, what's to reveal? It's all hanging out there, you know, short of the Russian stuff we can talk about, you know, who may be financing him. But, I mean, beyond that, I think, like, there's, you know, there's not this sort of dynamic of, like, I've got to let everybody know and see what I see. No, everybody basically, you know, a lot of people see it.
So here's the thing, and this might blow up in my face if I say this, but I think the thing that gives Trump a little, you know, that animates his whole rise with, a kind of a literary power is that there are elements to the things that he says that are true. You know, like, I think the hidden thing about Trump isn't that he's just uniformly across the board a crook. What gave his speeches power and I think propelled him to the presidency, at least to the nomination anyway, was that he mixed in his absurd behavior with truths. I mean, I remember watching him in New Hampshire talk about the antitrust exemption that insurance companies enjoy, you know? And that was something, and he went into a long dissertation about it. In a very smart way, but he at least talked about it, and that was something that you never hear politicians talk about, in public. You know, that the conspiracy of financial interests that dominate both of the major political parties and the media, and how it's tuned out to what real people are going through. I mean, he kind of steals from the truth in order to give him his own thing. Energy, and that's something I think people have to face about him. You know, that they have to recognize that there are elements of that too.
Is it that he goes into topics that are usually either taboo. I mean, I don't mean taboo in like, you know, taboo in the sense that, you know, politicians won't talk about. I mean, you know, you don't hear a lot of people talking about antitrust, or, you know, maybe you do, you just don't hear them. It just doesn't, I don't know, resonate in the same way. I mean, I certainly, you know, Elizabeth Warren has given some antitrust speeches. I mean, I've never seen anybody cover it. Sure. And people don't cover it. It's just, I guess, that he's going out and, I mean, what is it that makes that unique? Or is that, you know?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, one of the things that makes it hard for people to understand why Trump is where he is because people have this instantaneous knee-jerk reaction to him that he's a monster and a complete idiot, which is completely true, but it obscures the fact that there are reasons why he was successful, you know, and some of those reasons were that, you know, on this issue of talking about things that other politicians don't necessarily talk about. I mean, my take on this is that he's a gluttonous personality, right? He consumes everything, like, kind of omnivorously. He's into women, he's into attention, he wants to be famous in 19 different ways. He also gobbles up political positions, and he will espouse any opinion that he thinks will get him more attention and more praise. And so when he's with certain crowds, if it fits his narrative to say that Wall Street is corrupt and that Goldman Right. Sachs owns politicians, he'll do that. And that doesn't mean that, you know, and even though he himself is crooked and not sincere when he's saying it, that doesn't mean that the criticism that he's citing isn't true. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So he'll take bits and pieces of true things and just kind of swallow them and regurgitate them, and it will add to this kind of snowballing celebrity phenomenon that he is, and it makes him seem bigger, and it makes all the people that he was running against seem smaller because he's a man of all positions. You know what I'm saying?
What do you think of, like, I mean, I'm sure you've noticed there's been a almost an entire genre of reporting now of sort of people who say, like, well, I voted for Trump, but I never thought he would get rid of our health care. Or, you know, like, I mean, there was that big piece, I think, in Sarah Cliff wrote in that, you know, that Kentucky county where three quarters of the people are on Medicaid or, the Kentucky Connect. And they're like, well, I just don't think he's going to do that. Or, I mean, I saw a piece today that was, I voted for Trump, but not against Planned Parenthood. And
right.
And then there was this other piece of, you know, women who were talking in their own voices about Donald Trump. And they're like, deep down, I think he's a good man, like my ex-husband. You know, this type of, like, do you think that's, I mean, is it, could you go and find the same for any candidate? Or is it that reporters are looking for it? Or is it there out there people who are just like, I didn't put the whole idea that I didn't take him seriously as a Republican. I just thought he was going to be different. Or, I mean, how real is that phenomenon?
I mean, I think that's a universal human characteristic. In Russia, they talk about, when I lived in Russia, this is a phenomenon that they've talked about for centuries, which is that, you know, during Tsarist times, you would have, you know, the local officials and even like the local secret police would go and they would, you know, beat the crap out of somebody or steal their lands or embezzle the local budget. And all the local people would be writing letters to the Tsar under the impression that the Tsar isn't aware of how things are, you know, happening on the ground, right? There's this desire among people to believe that their leaders are good and that the bad things that are going on, the leader must be ignorant about. And that happens, I think, with all people. It happens on the left with Obama. It's just that with Trump, it's so obvious because all people have to do is look at what he's actually said, and it contradicts what they actually believe about him. But the problem is that, again, this gets back to the whole issue of what news sources do people believe. You know, if the Washington Post says that Donald Trump is going to take away our health care, and Breitbart says it's not, he's not, and Trump says he's not, then there are people out there who, you know, will stick to their guns and say, I just don't believe he's going to do it, you know? So I think there's that, too.
And what's amazing is all this is happening, and the guy's not even president yet. I mean, it just like right. feels like he's been president for, like, 3 years, and it's just, God, it's been so relentless. When's this going to end? It hasn't even started yet.
I feel like it's going to be another year until tomorrow. Don't you? I mean, like, every day is just so long, right? It's so, just amazing.
So long. It's so exhausting. I mean...
But yeah, but just to back up just for a second, the Goldman Sachs thing is a classic example, right? And Trump spends all year running against Goldman Sachs. He uses it in campaign commercials. He talks about how Hillary is owned by Goldman. Ted Cruz is owned by Goldman. His wife is owned by Goldman. Then Trump turns around, he's got 5 Goldman people in the government, like, already, you know, and he's even got a pro-Brexiter as his chief anti-Brexiter as his chief economic advisor. Like, Gary Cohn was very explicitly, like, this globalist, you know, pro-EU person, and Trump brings him into the government. That's the total anathema to what all of Trump's supporters believe, but, you know, whatever, they don't care.
What do you think is going on, like, in the organization / soon to be administration? I mean, you know, like, this story about Rick Perry that came out today, which I don't know if you saw in the Times, is unbelievable. Have you heard this story?
No. What does it say?
All right, let me read. I mean, like, literally, I could read the entire first page of this, and people's jaws are going to drop. The Times headline is "Learning Curve as Rick Perry Pursues a Job He Initially Misunderstood." Rick Perry has been nominated the energy secretary, the head of the energy department. When President Trump offered Rick Perry the job of energy secretary 5 weeks ago, Mr. Perry gladly accepted, believing he was taking on a role as a global ambassador for the American oil and gas industry that he had long championed in his home state. In the days after, the former Texas governor discovered he would be doing no such thing. He would become, instead, the steward of a vast national security complex he almost knew nothing about, caring for the most fearsome weapons on the planet, the United States nuclear arsenal. And then it goes on. This is the fourth graph. If you asked him on the first day, he said, okay. If you asked him on that first day, he said, yes. I would have said, quote, I want to be an advocate for energy, said Michael McKenna, a Republican energy lobbyist who advised Mr. Perry's 2016 presidential campaign and worked on the Trump's transition energy department team in its early days. If you asked him now, he'd say, I'm serious about the challenges facing the nuclear complex. It's been a learning curve. Now, he is replacing Ernest Moniz, who was the chairman of the MIT physics department and directed the linear accelerator at MIT's Laboratory for Nuclear Science. Before Moniz, the job belonged to Stephen Chu, who won a Nobel Prize for physics. And now it's Rick Perry, who thought he was going to be a goodwill ambassador for the oil and gas industry in the country.
Oops.
Now it's Tweedledum, right?
I mean, so...
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And so,
yeah.
I mean, if this is the case, and I don't know that every position is like this, because the other ones seem to be, but this one just seemed to be like, dang. I mean,
think about Ben Carson, who's going to have to be involved with reorganizing Fannie and Freddie. So you're dealing with the most complex kinds of financial instruments that exist in the world, and he's going to have to revamp the most powerful pile of money in the world, and he knows nothing about any of that stuff. His qualifications are that he grew up in a poor neighborhood. So I don't know.
I mean,
that's similar.
Do you have a sense from, I mean, you know, having been on the campaign, like, who's driving this? Like, it just feels like to me, throughout this entire process, it's basically been as if you were to take, like, literally like an 8-year-old and just, you know, put them in a room with a bunch of different dolls and just say, pick out a cabinet. And they just pick it based upon, like, the look and, like, I'm going to have a fireman over here and I'm going to have a, you know, a construction worker over here and that black doll over there at HUD and this and that. And that's basically the way he picked it out. without any political coherence or just maybe just, you know, I promised this to Mike Pence, so he gets to pick that one. I mean, what is there any logic to what we're seeing?
No, I don't think so. And I say this in the book, too. I thought one of the things that was really interesting about Trump's campaign is that it was so different from other presidential campaigns, that where the candidate has this long trail of attendant staff everywhere he goes, and there's a court and courtiers, you know, and or courtiers, whatever, however you pronounce that. With Trump, it wasn't like that. Trump's campaign, there was no organization. Trump's campaign was just a couple of like overheated ganglia behind his eyes, right? I mean, there was no anything at any given moment. Just whatever idea came into his head, that was what the campaign's position on things were. And so, you know, if you look at the even the way he's behaved since he's been elected, there's no person sitting around saying, "Hey, should we take a shot at Meryl Streep over the Golden Globes thing?"
Right.
You know, I mean, he's just up at night like anybody else, you know, probably with a couple of highballs in him, doing this stuff. And when it comes to the, I think if there's nobody who has enough oomph to challenge him on things like that, you know, where is it going to come from? Where's the plan going to come from? Who are the people who are going to say, you know, we should have this person and that person and that person in the cabinet? I think this is just Donald Trump's whim that he's decided to have this collection of people. And it makes perfect sense that not only are they incompetent to, you know, govern wisely, but they're not even competent to govern in a direction that might be regressive, right? So if you were looking for somebody who was going to have energy policy that would be, you know, would hugely benefit the energy companies, normally you would put somebody in there who might have politics different than yours, but it would at least know something, right?
Right.
And Perry is just a complete idiot. And the same thing with Carson at HUD. You know, it's not like he's an expert in this stuff, but an expert in the wrong direction. He just doesn't know. So,
I mean, it's really just going to be a race in a lot of these instances. Which Betsy DeVos is one of those examples, I would say. I mean, a guy like Tom Price, he clearly has an idea of what he wants to do in terms of cutting health care and cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security. I think, you know, someone like Pruitt from Oklahoma clearly has an agenda. I mean, the guy's been suing. And Mnuchin, definitely. Tillerson, I think, as well.
Sure.
I mean, we had Dan Dicker on the other day. He's a former oil trader who's like, you know, I see oil people throughout this entire thing. This is going to be completely, at least in terms of foreign policy and to a certain extent with domestic, when you got a guy like Pruitt, it's all about carbon, you know, extraction, essentially. And if you're on one list or the other, you either have it or you don't have it. And that's the way that things are going to be drawn. But there's definitely this sort of hodgepodge quality to this outside of that. And it feels like, you know, if I'm sure there are lobbyists just waiting to run into Ben Carson's office. And, you know, my tendency is to believe that Ben Carson's, you know, the first guy who comes in who sounds like they knows what they're doing. He's just going to say, like, okay, what do you think I should do here? What do you think I should do
exactly.
there? And that's it.
Exactly. Right. Right. But I don't think that was like a plan.
No.
You know, we're going to put this guy in here because he's going to be a total patsy for the energy lobbyists that I secretly want to put in, you know, run into his office. I think this was more like Trump sitting back at some point saying, who do I know who knows anything about energy or you know, like, or it might even be like a word association kind of
right.
a thing. Like, you know, you ask Trump, you throw the word energy at him, he might just think Rick Perry because Rick Perry's in Texas. You know what I mean? I mean, like, that's...
I think he had a list of, like, people he wanted to give something to. And then
right.
I think, like, Pence probably got to choose some of the other ones. But, like, all the hangover, the leftover ones that nobody cared about, you know, like the energy, to, you know, the energy department, as far as they wanted to, they all wanted to cut it. So just put Rick Perry there. He wanted to cut it. Just have him. He'll do
right.
something with it. And nobody... Nobody talked about what it was.
Mnuchin, he might have gotten the job because Trump liked American Sniper or one of those movies that he produced. You know what I mean? It could be that stupid. We have no idea. You know.
So let's let's talk about. And I guess the next aspect of it. I mean, there was one story written by Mike Allen in that Axis, whatever that thing he's got going. I don't really anything I read by Mike Allen. I think has. I don't know, less than a grain of truth, but it's interesting to see what angle is coming out. And supposedly, Trump is getting a little bit nervous sitting in the office, starting to realize, this is now, because up to this point, it's been very different, right? There's no, he can do whatever he wants because there's no constraints. But starting tomorrow, he's got to theoretically be in the White House.
Right.
Starting tomorrow, it's just sort of people are going to expect him to do stuff, not just tweet, but actually do stuff.
Maybe. I mean, we've had presidents who don't work a lot before.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to remember that. I mean, Reagan didn't. He didn't put in a lot of hours. There are two different ways to look at this. And it gets to the question of why does Trump even want to be president? Here's a guy who's been running all over the world, romping with models and playing golf, and is a person who's had that schedule and has just done nothing but spend money and have sex for 40 years or whatever it is? Is he going to want to have Jimmy Carter's job?
Right.
and go gray with stress within 10 minutes? I mean, that's not going to. But I don't think that the presidency is not going to be like that for Donald Trump. It's going to be more like it was for Reagan or for George Bush even. I think you can do this job on a couple of hours a day. It's been demonstrated. And, Reagan didn't even really read. He didn't read briefings. He didn't do homework. He had people make videos for him if he had a difficult subject, so he wouldn't have to actually turn pages. So I think they can dumb down the job enough even for Donald Trump.
But is Don't there, you? Well, I mean, the only thing I would say yes, if there was a Don Regan or a Dick Cheney figure, in the White House, but Rance Priebus is the adult in the room, right? I mean, I guess Pence to a certain extent, but Bannon, I think Bannon, you tell me, you might have a better sense of this than I do, but from what I've read about Bannon, he's just sort of waiting to create some type of chaos, it seems to me.
Bannon to me is the rogue figure in all this. I think that's the, even though he's theoretically got the David Axelrod job,
mm-hmm.
I think his entire view here is going to be, his job is the politics of things. And, in terms of where our numbers are, how are we positioning ourselves to get reelected? How is this going to go over? All of those things. In terms of policy, I don't know how much interest Bannon's really going to have in that. I mean, his core issues, are really all about culture. And so I don't know. It seems to me they're going to have to find somebody who does the nuts and bolts of actual governing. Or maybe they won't. I mean, who knows? I mean, is there a precedent for the executive branch having, basically pleading no contest to 99% of the issues that are going to come across their desk? It's just such a bizarre situation that we're in. We have no idea how it's going to work out.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a vacuum there, right? And everybody, there's going to be multiple people trying to fill it. That's just my sort of systems experience, being
right.
in any type of when there's a vacuum, you've got all these people who are coming in to try and fill it. I mean, for all I know, it could be that Michael Cohen, the lawyer, or that Boris,
right.
what's his name? Or, all right, well, let's talk about the Russia stuff. I saw you on MSNBC and you were there with Malcolm Nance and talking about the Russia hacking. And I think at that time, and this was a day or two after things turned, it seemed a little bit more real. It seemed to me anyways, the idea that, and I think, well, you express your opinion on it, because I think your articulation of it is sort of similar to what my feeling has been, largely speaking, which is, you know, broadly, I'm not surprised Russia would try and influence our election. We do it, for that matter.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm still in this place where, from what everybody says, and I've talked to people who are like cyber experts, and they're very convincing when they say that the case is almost irrefutable that the Russians hacked the DNC. Obviously, Trump himself has since said that, that he believes that that's true, and that there's evidence that they, you know, gave it to WikiLeaks. But beyond that, you know, it's the next step in the story that really makes me nervous as a reporter, because even though certain things are believable, there's just not a whole lot of information that we have to go on to say, make a statement that would be an extraordinary one for anyone to make, which is that Trump and Putin were in some kind of collusive arrangement, that this was an October surprise / Manchurian candidate story, and that kind of stuff. There are insinuations to that effect that are being made all over the place. I thought the most interesting detail in that respect was the news that came out of Israel from sources like Haaretz and Ynet, that the United States intelligence officials had told Israeli intelligence officials that Trump was compromised and that they shouldn't share intelligence with him. Now, that's like an order of magnitude beyond what the intelligence agencies even said in their assessment that they released. You know, they assessed that Russia did the hack, but they didn't say that Trump was compromised in that report. So that makes me wonder, what do they have if they're saying that, you know, privately, and why can't they make that public? But beyond that, I don't know how you feel, but I don't know what we can do. I don't know what we can say.
Yeah, well, there was a story, I think it came out today, or maybe it was yesterday, McClatchy, which confirms or reiterates previous reporting about there being sort of a group of intelligence agencies that have been investigating this, you know, a joint task force type of situation. But according to McClatchy, the FBI and five other law enforcement and intelligence agencies have collaborated for months, like starting in the spring, involving including the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. One of the allegations involves whether a system for routinely paying thousands of Russian-American pensioners may have been used to pay some email hackers in the United States or supply money to intermediaries who would then pay the hackers. And then the other one was, in addition to finding out who financed the hack, right, that there seems to be some implication. The other aspect of the investigation deals with a direct funding for Trump's campaign, involving also Americans associated with Trump's campaign. And then there were the reports, you saw this, right, where there was a FISA warrant that was rejected in June, a FISA warrant rejected in July, and then one, we don't know if it was rejected in October, but there was sort of like some notion that it was the granted.
Part of it was accepted.
Yes.
It was accepted on the Russians, and it was rejected vis-a-vis the Americans.
So what do you make of that?
So, but again, this is like, if you're a reporter, what can you report here? You can report at most the existence of an investigation, but anybody can start an investigation into anything, and that doesn't tell you anything about, you know, what kind of facts they have. If we had the warrant application for the FISA situation, we might know exactly what they have and what their basis for thinking something is. But my sense is that if the FISA court, which is, you know, takes place in secret and has a very low standard, you know, they almost never decline warrants from what I've seen in previous stories about the FISA court. For them to decide not to give a warrant against somebody
twice.
Makes me think that, yeah, twice or three times even, right? Because, you know,
we don't
elements
know about,
of,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, that doesn't tell us anything. Again, like the idea that they're investigating this stuff, it doesn't give us any information about what the actual there is, you know.
Right.
And that's what's so frustrating about this story is that, you know, to me there are really only two possibilities here. Either we have a compromised president, which is like this incredible once in history kind of a thing to happen, or we have what has to be on some level some kind of organized campaign to make us think that the intelligence agencies believe that. And that would also be extraordinary, because that would be meddling in the
right.
domestic discussion on a level that, you know, the CIA and the FBI and, you know, the NSA have never done before, at least that we know about, right?
So, right.
You know, both. I don't see. Could it be anything else? I just don't see how it could be anything else.
And what's weird about, you know, sort of the latter, okay, is that. Mm-hmm. If it is like just a question of like they're trying to make it, you know, maybe there was no FISA warrant application, right? I mean, would it be
right.
possible? I mean, maybe there, you know, maybe there was, maybe the June and July applications and the October act never even existed, because throughout those 3 points, there's nobody who could have really thought like this guy's going to be president and we want to undercut him. We're gonna start the project Undercut Donald Trump as president in July or June of 2016. Everyone would look around going like, you're crazy, man. Like, why are you wasting your time? Let's undercut Clinton.
Right.
You know, like that's the part that sort of strikes me.
But that cuts both ways though. I mean, you can interpret that in a couple of ways. You know, let's say, yeah, on the one hand, it suggests that it's true, because why would they even think that Donald Trump would have been president back in July or in May, you know, when,
or October for that matter,
but on the other hand, you know, you have a Democratic administration, and you know, it's conceivable that, you know, maybe this was on some level, you know, it's so hard to say, but both things just stretch credulity to such a degree
that it's hard to wrap your head around it. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Have you?
It's hard to wrap your head around the idea that he could actually be compromised, and it's also hard to wrap your head around the idea that that somebody was out to create this the impression that.
Well,
he
wait,
was,
the compromise thing is somewhat different. Let's just be clear here. There's two issues with his relationship with Russia, right, that are at least, you know, discussed. One is that they've been sort of blackmailing him, right, because
mm-hmm.
They have, you know, pictures of him getting peed on or something. And,
right.
And he is so deep into Russian oligarchs who are closely aligned with Putin that, you know, he is indebted to them and they could crash his business, which, you know, even now.
Yeah, it would be more the latter, I think, because is Trump really blackmailable? I mean, like, you'd have to have shame to be blackmailed.
Yeah,
but,
I think so, right? I mean, and maybe, I don't know, maybe they're not, maybe the plan was never to, you know, maybe, you know, it's also quite possible that, like, Russia was just, we're just going to do this stuff because it doesn't cost us anything, right?
Right.
Like, they never thought that any of this stuff would happen. I mean, that,
mm-hmm.
that to me, I think like the most obvious explanation for all of this is like everybody's operating without thinking that it was going to go this far. I mean, just sort of like mm-hmm. in the same way that we all thought like, yeah, Trump, maybe he'll do well in the primary. Maybe he'll win the primary. Well,
right.
maybe he'll make it a little bit closer than we thought. And then holy shit, he won. I mean, there's nobody in this process, whether, you know, regardless of what anybody believes, whether it was like Putin or Russian hackers or James Comey, who could have predicted, you know, in mid-October, Trump's going to win if we do X, Y, or Z. Nobody would have thought that. That would have been irrational. And
right.
I mean, I think like even I was speculating yesterday, the narrative about Comey could be completely wrong. He could have, for all we know, on October 26th when he came out, or whatever it was, October 20th when he came out with that letter, he could have been doing that because he thought, we may end up indicting Donald Trump. And if I don't go out of my way to show that I was willing to, you know, investigate Hillary Clinton, it might be difficult to indict him once she becomes president.
Right.
I mean, because,
yeah,
you know,
that's possible.
I mean, it's, who knows? I mean, I'm not saying it would be the smart thing to do, but it, you know, it's like there's some logic to it. Like, oh, Donald Trump's not going to win the election. We just got our FISA court warrant. I'm getting feedback that this thing could be for real. And now this letter that I've been sitting on for 3 weeks about Hillary Clinton, I'm just going to send it in. So she's inoculated from any sort of charges of retribution because he claimed he was going to prosecute her after the election. And then all of a sudden,
that's really interesting. I never thought of that. Yeah, that's possibly.
It's possible. I mean, that maybe because, you know, why doesn't Comey tell these Democratic congressmen, I'm not investigating Trump anymore? Why would he not close the door on this?
Right. Right. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, and even the fact that they kept it so close to his vest, I mean, he must have known how explosive that was. So, you know, it's really interesting. It underscores how conscious of a decision it must have been to leak the Hillary news. You know, that clearly that was a huge step, and he must have put a lot of thought into whether or not he was going to do that. You know, given that they didn't do that on the Trump side.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you've run into USAs who do public corruption. What Comey did was completely unheard of.
Right.
I mean, they never do stuff like that. They don't even do it if they have stuff. Never mind.
Right.
They think they have stuff. Because they just don't do it that close to an election.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, forget about that. They don't even comment on investigations that everybody in the world knows that they're conducting.
Right.
You know, they won't talk about a case even after they've presented the evidence in court. You know, like if you ever covered like a Justice Department case, you know, you try to get a government spokesman to even say, well, tell me about what you know, that exhibit that you brought into trial today. They won't even do that, like not even after they've made it public. So for him to actually disclose that they have something going on, it's just so out of the ordinary for them. It was amazing.
And so let me ask you this. I mean, lastly, like, what do you have a sense like now? And because I imagine this is going on in newsrooms across the country. You don't work at a newspaper, but you're a reporter, and you're going to be sort of looking now for sort of the next angle. I mean, do you have a sense of like what you're going to do? Like, do you have a sense of like what your beat is going to be going forward?
I think, you know, what I'm going to try to focus on is Trump's relationship to the financial services community, probably. Just because that's a beat that I know pretty well, and you know that'll allow me to see what he's all about more quickly. Like just to give you an example, I'm working on a story now about Trump's. You know, it's basically about Trump's relationship to Goldman. There's a gigantic international corruption case involving Goldman, and whether or not the U.S. government goes forward with that. Under Trump's watch will tell us a lot about what their attitude towards regulation and enforcement is going to be, you know, in the years ahead. So, I think there's sort of meta issue with Trump. What does he mean for our culture and our history, and what kind of a person is he and all that? I mean, we have to think about those things, but that's really more of a job for like columnists and literary types. And in terms of just the reporting, you know, I don't know what to do except, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I don't know what to do except just sort of stick to trying to follow what it is that they're doing, you know?
The one thing I think, I mean, I think part of it is like I'm situated differently than I was back when we used to, you know, talk at on Air America. But
that's right, yeah, in the Bush days.
And I think, you know, I just don't know if I have the stomach to focus on Trump as much as what's happening in Congress.
Right.
Because that's where the real damage, at least from the issue sets that I tend to focus on and care about more are going to happen. I mean, we're going to see it in, and maybe not even Congress, maybe executive, and Betsy DeVos. I mean, God knows, you know, I'm not fully, you know, there's not a lot of people who cover like the education department beat. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's not a lot of reporters anymore who do that. I don't know if there ever was, but...
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but this is just such an interesting part. Trump's rise is coinciding with the fact that the entire media structure has been hollowed out to the point where there really aren't, you know, full-time investigative reporters on a whole range of beats.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that when you went to Congress and you covered the Senate or the House, you could go in there and there'd be like five reporters from like, you know, Farm Report Weekly would be in there. You know what I mean? And they would be telling, you know, writing these long, articles about what happened today in farm policy. And, you know, there just aren't that, those sort of section experts don't exist in our business anymore, because the gigantic newspapers are all hollowed out to the core, and they're using wire services to do their job. And local newspapers have been crushed. The alternative weeklies don't have any budget anymore. So it's, you know what I'm saying? It's like a meeting.
It's a real problem.
Two different phenomena. Yeah.
And because, you know, when I would talk to reporters who are covering education, just as an example, they would... There was never a question of like, we need to see what's going on in the education department. It's more like, we need to see what policies are coming out of the education department, because it was less about what was going on inside the department and more about just sort of these broad policies that are coming out. But with Betsy DeVos's agenda, it is not going to be about policies outside of like where like vouchers can go, let's say, and small minutia about, you know, sort of administrative details, it seems to me, that are just going to drop funding in places that are not going to make any news, but are going to fundamentally alter, you know, you're not going to feel it. There's just almost like the middle is going to be hollowed out. Like, you know, locally, they might be talking to the schools like, oh, our schools are hurting, but you can't see that trail that leads from Betsy DeVos to that. And that's, I don't know, that's going to be a problem. I mean, it's going to be...
it's going to be a problem. Definitely.
We got that same thing, I think, with the EPA too, right? Like, we got a little bit of that, and there's at least some climate reporting infrastructure that exists, and investigative that is, you know, things like Inside Climate News that have a little more familiarity with, let's say, the EPA. But, you know, who covers the Energy Department, right?
Nobody.
Because
I used to know somebody whose entire job was to cover the Department of Energy. Actually, it was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and you know that person doesn't exist anymore. I mean, he does exist, but he doesn't have that job. There just aren't people there are fewer people whose job it is to monitor all the thousands of things that the executive branch does. There are still plenty of activists like in the financial sector. If something happens, in terms of Fed policy or interest rates or enforcement on a big case, or the IG of the SEC issues a report that has something damning in it. You know, there are five or six different people who are going to call reporters all over the city and let them know. But in those other areas, I don't think that community of people has just gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's coinciding with the fact that we have a low information president to begin with.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So it's like this idiocracy writ large. We have an unthinking president colluding with this low information media landscape, which is insane.
So we're totally fucked. Good time to buy into alcohol futures.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, it's time to start drinking heavily, right?
I know you got a thing in Dumbo tonight, right? Is that right? In
yes,
Brooklyn?
I do. Yep. I'm going to be at the Powerhouse at 7 o'clock tonight to do a little presentation on the book, and it's going to be on C-SPAN. So definitely people should come out.
Maybe I'll go down to that. We'll have my one night out.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, in this year. I mean this fiscal year, not even this calendar year. Matt Taibbi, thanks so much, buddy. I appreciate it.
All right, Sam. Take care. Talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Powerhouse.
It's a good venue.
What?
Did he say I love you too?
He may have.
Or did he say talk to you too?
Pretty classic. It's pretty typical. Doesn't surprise me. I'd say 75% of our guests, when they sign off, they say I love you.
It's only Kimmler.
Andy Kimmler says that.
Also, Walter Block says that.
Walter Block said that to me.
The reductus de figure mortis.
All the libertarians, they say I love you.
That would actually be great if they said, hey, you just revealed to me that I'm completely illogical and I'm advocating for the Scientology of politics. Thank you. Thanks for educating me, Sam. I love you.
65% of the professors that we interview, they say I love you, Sam. People I don't even know. It's crazy. I mean,
I think you get a little bit carried away with yourself.
It's a little, it's called interview technique. Folks, this show relies on your memberships. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can give a gift of the Majority Report by going to majoritygift.com. You can leave us a review on iTunes. You can get Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. It's fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Great coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
Is that Survival Sam coffee? Is that an existing line?
No, that was from Break Room Live. That was from Break Room Live. We had Marin had an angry chef version. Because that's what happened with Just Coffee, is that we got contacted by a guy named Mike who was working there. He said, we listened to the show. Would you ever advertise? And I was like, oh my God, we found an advertiser for this show, which is definitely going to be off. And then I was like, and this is even better because even though the money would go to Air America, we can get them to pay us in coffee. And you and I, Marin, will get free coffee. And that was the whole thing. That was the angle. We're going to get coffee. And then Marin, when Marin did his little podcast thing, whatever he calls it, WTF. Give me a break. GMB. GMAB. Wow. He basically changed their business because all of a sudden, like, this one little place in Wisconsin, in Madison, was getting around the country.
When you guys left Break Room Live, Marin also gave the coffee grinder to Film Guy Matthew, who says he still has it, but probably sold it on eBay. Probably tried to send it to Marin, maybe.
Also,
sign it.
If you buy crap from Amazon or Jet.com, go to our link at MajorityReportKickback.com and click through the link. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. And right now on Jet, I think, let me just pull this up because I'm not very good about this, but try the coupon code TRIPLE15. TRIPLE15. That's for new shoppers at Jet. You can save 15% off your first three orders, up to $30. Also, if you keep using Welcome15, you'll be able to. So try those. TRIPLE15, Welcome15. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com and click on the link. So tomorrow, folks, I'm not sure what we're going to do, but you know, you'll show up and we'll do it. What is this?
It's just a funny moment that just happened with Rick Perry and Al Franken at the hearings. Nothing deep. Okay. Amusing. I am just you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, here is Rick Perry. He is at the
hearings right now.
The
energy
department.
This is the Rick Perry video. Are we doing
the funny thing? I am'd you.
That's not this.
Okay. We'll do another Rick Perry thing there, but we'll leave with a funny one because
was a devastating interview.
People are freaking out a little bit, and with good reason. We're going into sort of some dark times, but that's... Hey, folks, if there were no gallows, there'd be no gallows humor. Think about that.
That's a great point. All right, so check this out.
So here is Senator Al Franken. Now, well, I want to be clear something here because I want to describe what we've got. This is the Energy Department hearings. Senator Al Franken, who knew exactly that when he became senator, what he'd be doing is representing a state of Minnesota. He knew that's he. So when he went for that job, he knew what he was doing. And Rick Perry, who thought when he was taking when he would be taking the job of Energy Department Secretary, he thought he was going to be a goodwill ambassador for the oil and energy company industry around the world. Turns out he's in charge of all the nukes. Who knew? Here's Al Franken.
My office. Did you enjoy meeting me?
I hope you were as much fun on that dais as you were on your couch.
Well.
May I rephrase that, sir?
Please. 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 Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord.
Well, I think we found our Saturday Night Live soundbite.
There you go.
There you go.
Did the guy behind him tell him to say that? Turn around.
Could have been hold on one second. He just gave me a soundbite, Senator.
I think I just... He's the guy behind me who writes jokes.
That was one
also
of the guys that was on the stage forever telling the Benghazi story, I think. Isn't it?
On the stage forever telling the Benghazi story. I do recognize that guy. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Oh, my God.
I think you might be right. I think you might be right. He might be one of those guys from the yes, I think you might
then
be right.
Then went back for shelter at the Rough. And then we went to the Rough, and then we went, Hillary Clinton's a bitch, vote for Trump, thank you. Sorry, I went 40 minutes over.
Apparently it worked.
Yeah, exactly. And incidentally, for all you liberal commentators out here mocking this right now, it's going to work.
Sack.
See you behind Rick Perry is swearing in to oversee our nuclear arsenal.
It's not.
Bye.
Hi, next time you see me, I'll be sitting behind Rick Perry as he takes over the nukes. How crazy. Can you believe it?
It's not that guy.
It's not that
and
guy.
It looks nothing like either of those guys.
Well, he's a guy like that.
He's a guy like that. He's a guy.
That's a good point.
Or he identifies as male.
I bet he says rough like that.
Yeah, he probably says rough.
Can you just believe it? I can't believe it. I just can't believe it.
Al Franken. What a cute little roly-poly Jew.
We are basically involved in one of the greatest experiments of probably all of our lifetimes. And that is to see, maybe you just don't need any expertise whatsoever
to run
some of these things.
That was another great moment, actually, in last week's SNL cold open. It was the opening. He's like, first, I'd like to answer the question that everybody's asking. This is real. We're not dreaming. Yes. This is actually happening.
God. Hang in there, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back,
We actually figured out who it is.
Who is it?
Marcus Luttrell.
He's a Navy SEAL. We'll figure out.
Yeah, so he was.
He was the Benghazi guy.
Okay,
he wasn't one of those Benghazi guys like
who
was 50
Benghazi guys.
But he was on stage, and good one, Matt.
Was impressive. Total Recall, Matt.
Ah, Rain Man strikes again.
Or wait, is that recognition? Anyway, good job. His eyes are askew, so that it makes him more recognizable. Asymmetrical.
Oh, Matt's face. Or that guy?
No, not Matt. Okay. The guy.
Good idea to not make casting couch jokes when you're up before your committee hearing, Governor.
Listen, make some casting couch jokes. Then people forget that you don't know what the hell you're doing about the nukes.
They'll be laughing so much about the idea that Senator Franken's a Jewish porn producer and you're auditioning for him that they'll forget the fact that you are literally going to lead us to nuclear Armageddon. See how that works?
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM the show via our app, which you can pick up at Majority App. If you have emailed the show and we haven't responded to you either at our members' email or our Majority Reporters, just to have a little bit of patience in a little bit of a crazy week. All right, we'll be back in a minute.